My name is Maria Shepherd. I was wrongly convicted in 1991 of manslaughter in the death of my daughter, and I'm an advocate against wrongful convictions.
Thanks for joining me for episode 26 of Actual Innocence, a podcast to help bring awareness of wrongful conviction and the need for reform in criminal justice. I want to start by thanking everyone who supported my sponsors after the announcement in last week's episode. I know that my listeners want this show to stick around for a long time, and you have been a tremendous help. Advocacy sometimes starts with one person or one podcast, but when so many people band together based on their shared cause, we, my friends, can move mountains. Once again, I ask, if possible, if you could please support today's sponsor, either by using their product or sharing my code with someone who's in need of their services. If not, if you could send them a little thank you on social media for supporting the show, it would be very helpful, and I would be very grateful. Also, be sure to listen all the way through to the end to hear more about the upcoming schedule of episodes and the season finale. Today's episode is unique in that it is my first episode in which I interview someone from outside the United States. Unfortunately, it's not unique in the fact that it's a woman who was falsely convicted of a crime against her child that wasn't a crime at all. We're going to pause for a second so we can talk about today's sponsor. In previous episodes, I mentioned that I was having my degree framed by FrameBridge.com for a fraction of the cost of having it done at a framing or craft store. Well, I'm really excited because yesterday I got the email telling me that my degree was framed and on its way back to me. Watch Twitter for pictures, and don't forget to submit your own pictures to be displayed in the gallery on the Actual Innocence website. The process was so easy and quick. To get a picture or a piece of art framed, you just go to FrameBridge.com and choose your frame, or they even have designers that will give you advice. You can upload your photo from your computer or even directly from Instagram. When you've made your selection, you get to preview your picture in the frame. Or if you're like me and want to frame a picture or document that you already have, you just enter the dimensions and they take care of the shipping both ways. It was so affordable. Instead of paying hundreds of dollars, like at a framing store, their prices start at just $39. And did I mention the shipping is free? Plus, when you use my code, ACTUAL, that's A-C-T-U-A-L, you get 15% off your first order. I loved that they had a frame for every style, from clean and classic to more eclectic styles. Plus, because they use premium real wood moldings and acid-free mat board and foam board and an acrylic glazing that will never shatter, your piece is sure to be protected. So, get started today framing your photos or art. Go to FrameBridge.com and use my promo code ACTUAL to save 15% off your first order. Remember, FrameBridge.com, promo code ACTUAL. Maria was a young 21-year-old mother who was pregnant with her youngest child when she was wrongfully convicted of manslaughter. An already tragic situation, the death of her stepdaughter, was amplified when she became the target of the police and a poorly trained doctor looking for someone to blame. Since her exoneration, she's become an advocate and strives to educate people about the issues leading to wrongful conviction. I'm Brooke, and this is Maria's story. You're the third woman that I've interviewed, and in each case, it has to do with a crime that wasn't a crime. It was, you know, some kind of medical issue, and in every case, the mother was blamed for this medical issue. And so I'm glad that there are people like you who are out there making sure that that doesn't happen to other people.
I think it would be wrong if we didn't. But then again, everybody's experience and how they cope is different. My family and I have chosen to continue our journey to champion for the wrongfully convicted. so that it will never happen or won't happen again in the future. It's really important that people are educated about it.
I'm going to be light for just a second. So since you are in Canada, I'm in the U.S., I just wanted to clarify some of the terms. Here, the prosecution, the person working for the government, we call them usually the state or the prosecutor, but it's my impression in Canada that that person is called the Crown?
The Crown Attorney.
The Crown Attorney, okay.
Yes.
And then I was told that people in Canada rarely use the word attorney, other than to say the Crown Attorney.
We actually, aside from using the word Crown Attorney, it's true, we actually use the word attorney very minimally, because for us, what an attorney is a lawyer. So it's just the choice of the word, really. So we actually relate attorney to somebody that's an American lawyer.
I'm just going to start way back in the very beginning.
Before October 91, before everything started, I was, you know, a mom. I was at home. I had my little ones at home. I had Jordan, my son. I was basically an at-home mom at the time. I was 21.
Were you married?
I was indeed. Yes, I was married in 1989 to my current husband, still my husband from then. The day really started off uneventful. We were just doing our standard routine. We had our breakfast. You know, we spent time in the master bedroom, which is generally where the crib was for the baby. And we were just in the room. And then later in the afternoon, Cassandra wasn't feeling very well. And she vomited. And it's just her. There's so many things happened that day that trying to pinpoint every moment of the day is actually quite difficult. It's painful to go through everything again. But I just remember at one point in that day, there was a moment when Cassandra was standing in front of me and her eyes rolled back into her head. And I didn't think anything of it. I didn't know at the time what a seizure was. I was a young mom. I was 21 and didn't know that she was actually having a seizure at the time. But the balance of the day was fine. We did our normal everyday, you know, eat breakfast, have lunch together. Cassandra had been going through quite a long period of illnesses, and, you know, she had just come home not long before that, and from the hospital, being in the hospital for a month. And it was a very difficult time, but we were happy to actually have her home. But that day was uneventful for the most part until I actually went downstairs to go get laundry, and I had my little one on the bed, and she had fallen off. And then my newborn also started to cry, and then Cassandra was close to me at that time, and when she was standing before me, her eyes rolled back in her head. And then that was it. Nothing else happened at that time, so I didn't think anything of it at the moment. And then the rest of the day happened.
Did she end up at a hospital?
She did. Later that evening, after her father got home from work, he had her and then he bathed her, and she wasn't feeling very well, but he did the bath and everything, and then he brought her downstairs. And then it was when she was downstairs in the living room that she had, she started to squeal, and she was clenching her fist, and it was a very, just bear with me, it's really hard to talk about. And then she was squealing, and we'd never ever seen her do anything like that before. And so we called 911, and my brother had a friend over at the house that was visiting, and CPR started, and we had emergency people on the phone, and there was so much going on. We didn't know what was happening. It was terrifying. It was nothing we'd ever, ever seen before.
She was 3, is that correct?
3 years, 3 months around then.
What do you think made the police suspect that it wasn't an accident or just a tragic health condition?
Well, back in 1991, which is around the time when my case was happening, SickKids Hospital, which is a big hospital here in Toronto, they had a unit, and they were called the SCAN unit, Suspected Child Abuse Network. And my understanding is back in 1991 that they were using what was called a think dirty approach. And that was, you know, if a child comes in, they're ill and they can't figure out, and this is my understanding, so, and they can't figure out what's wrong with her immediately, or they're not getting answers that would fit why she's feeling the way that she's feeling or why that child is in the hospital, immediately instinct, and they're told to think dirty, that something had happened, that a crime had happened or abuse had happened. And I'm now learning that I was not the only instance that this happened with. But at the same time, you know, Cassandra was, she still is. Cassandra's my stepdaughter. And it was a very, very difficult custody battle prior to that that was going on. And the mother was not liking me at all. Constant phone calls of allegations of, you know, me harming her, me doing something to her. And so I would think that a combination of that and a think dirty approach to the hospital would be why they pretty much targeted me.
What was your interaction with the police like? At what point did they approach you?
I know shortly after Cassandra's passing, I don't know exactly the day, but they asked us to go in and, you know, just speak to them. And my husband and I, we had no problem doing so. We cooperated with them. And then there was, I don't know offhand exactly how many times we met with them. I know there was at least three occasions. And so there was the initial interview, and then I remember another one where there was obviously, there was polygraph interview. There was another interview with an officer just with me alone. And this officer was quite clear with what he was expecting from me.
In the United States, polygraphs are not admissible in court. Is that the same in Canada?
I'm not entirely sure of how the polygraph theory works, but I do know that to some extent they allow polygraph evidence. I'm no expert in polygraphs, but they still do polygraphs, and it still is a matter of an argument in court whether or not the polygraph is admissible or inadmissible here. There was one officer that sat in a room alone with me before the polygraph occurred, and he was very clear to me, and he had said to me that, you know, if I don't give them what it is that they need, that the following morning the headlines would read stepmother kills stepdaughter, and that my children would be taken away. And then when I went in to go in for the polygraph, you know, there's the good officer, as they call it, and there's the other officer that's not so compassionate. But they played their roles very, very well, and they kept saying, you know, we don't think you're being very truthful with us. And despite everything that I was trying to say to them, I hadn't done anything. There was nothing. I didn't do anything to harm her. It was just consistent. Well, we have proof. And I just couldn't understand sitting there. What proof are you talking about?
Do you remember how long that was?
Oh, wow. I remember going in there. It was many hours. I know that.
I bet it felt like forever.
It did feel like forever. I was exhausted mentally. We had buried Cassandra not long before. And I had just been put on medication to deal with the, you know, my nerves and everything else, losing Casey. And it was a very difficult time. But we wanted to try and cooperate as much as possible. We didn't have anything to hide. We fully cooperated with the police at all times. I mean, they even came to our home. And we, you know, opened the door. We welcomed them and told them. I said, you're welcome to do whatever you need to do here. Like, we want to try and figure out what's happening here. And despite cooperating with them as much as possible, you know, we had never been involved in law, my husband and I, before. So we didn't realize that perhaps that they had the strategy that they were working on. And ultimately, I was the target at the end of it.
How long would you say after the initial questioning did they charge you?
I was arrested that night. they had me in a room, and an officer started typing out a statement. And they told me that my husband was downstairs in headquarters. And next thing you know, my husband's brought in the room, and I'm basically told to confess to my husband.
At what point in Canada do you get an attorney?
You're supposed to immediately, you know, the Miranda rights are supposed to be read, you know, right away. You're supposed to know right away your rights to counsel at any point when an officer is going to arrest you. They also tell you that, you know, you have a right to counsel or to consult with counsel prior to doing a polygraph. And my husband and I did that. We actually got a referral to somebody and ended up going to see that lawyer. And he basically told us that he was not available on the day of the polygraph and that he had a former RCMP officer that would be available to attend with us for a fee.
What is an RCMP officer?
Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer. And we didn't have the money, so we went in on our own.
I know here, if you can't afford an attorney, one is appointed to you. How does that work in Canada?
In Canada, they have what's called duty counsel. And a duty counsel is somebody that is present and available at the court if you need them there for that specific day. But if you cannot afford a lawyer, then you can apply to what's called the Legal Aid Ontario office, and they provide funding for those who are unable to fund counsel themselves.
And how was your attorney?
I had two. My first one was not good.
And the second one was?
Pretty much the one that I think saved my life and my family.
Can you tell me what court was like?
Oh, which part would you like to know?
How long was your trial?
I didn't have a trial. I entered into a guilty plea because Dr. Charles, well, I don't call him doctor now, but at the time he was known as Dr. Charles Smith. He was a world-respected doctor that seemed unassailable. Like, nobody seemed to want to challenge this gentleman. And we couldn't even find experts that were willing to challenge him. You know, my lawyer went to go and find other experts, they concurred with what Charles Smith said, which now we all know, we just don't understand how that was possible.
And what was it that he said?
He basically said that Cassandra died of a severe blow to the head. Towards the end of the trial proceedings, we had already started the trial, and I'm not sure how many days in, but we were, I think, a couple of days in. And I know that there was discussions from the Crown saying that if they were willing to offer a plea to me of 2 years less a day with 3 years probation and recommendations for a minimum security setting, potential early parole, and then if I didn't accept that and I proceeded to trial, then the Crown would seek to put me in a federal penitentiary for 5 years.
How long do you think it took you to make your choice?
I think there was a little bit of time, maybe a few weeks, because at the time I was seeing a forensic psychologist, and she was involved in helping me reach my decision. And given the circumstances that I was in, one of them specifically being that I was also pregnant with my youngest child now. And so I was pregnant. Nobody was willing to challenge the doctor. The best recourse to spare my family and also not lose my family or my children or have them potentially fostered out would be to take the plea. And I took it.
Did you get to say goodbye? Like, did you get to explain to your children? I know they were very small that you were going away.
at the time when I entered the guilty plea, I was given, I can't remember if it was 2 or 3 weeks, but I was given some time, and my husband and I were given some time to arrange for living arrangements for the kids. So we had to find an apartment where my husband would live with them. And the kids were way too young. The children were way, way too young to understand at the time what was going on. And my son, I'm just trying to think now, he must have been about 5 years old at the time. And so, I mean, trying to explain to a five-year-old why you're going away, the best way that I could do to explain it to him was the morning when he was leaving for daycare and I was turning myself in for my sentence. I told my son that I would be away for about 32 weeks rather than 8 months. So it sounded a bit shorter for him to understand.
Were they able to visit you, or did you not want them to visit you?
Well, I first went to the Metro Toronto West Detention Center, and in there, you can only see and have visits. There's no touch visits. So it's plexiglass, and I didn't want to see my children there, so I didn't see my kids there. I refused to have them brought into that environment. But ultimately, when I was transferred and classified and brought into Vanier Center for Women, which was then at the time in Brampton, I was able to have touch visits with them.
And how would you describe prison in general? I mean, what was it like to be there?
It's extremely terrifying. When I first walked into the Metro Toronto West Detention Center, I was being processed to administration and discharge, admission and discharge. And I was told at that time that when I go into the range where I would be placed, that if anybody asked me why I was there, that I had murdered my husband. Because if people had known that I was in there for a crime involving a child, especially one of my own, that the extreme danger, potentially killed, get attacked. So I was placed in protective custody.
And you were pregnant at the time. Did they look out for your health?
Well, various different settings. So the day that I turned myself in for sentence and they were bringing me in the paddy wagon over to the Metro West Detention Center, I was handcuffed and shackled. And it wasn't until I arrived at the Metro West Detention Center and I was about to be offloaded from the truck that somebody yelled out that I was pregnant and that they need to remove the shackles right away. And then I was placed into my range and I was, I guess you want to call it, admitted into the prison at that time. And I would get my medicines once in a while, but I had to take a tuberculosis shot. There was other things that I had to do in order to protect myself and the baby.
How long had you been in prison when your child was born?
I was released from prison just weeks, not long, like literally, when was it? I was released in March. So the same month that I was released was the same month that I gave birth to my daughter. I must have been out 2 weeks.
And how much time did you end up serving?
So 8 months in custody. So that was 8 months in custody. And then I did some time also on day parole. So from March until June of 1993, I was in a halfway house. And then June of 1993, I was paroled into the community again. The Children's Aid Society was very much involved, and I was not allowed to be alone. Even when my daughter was born, after I gave birth to my daughter, I wasn't allowed to be alone with her. I would only be able to see her for short periods, and my husband would have to be with her when she was first born.
You're talking to me now, and you're an advocate for an exoneration. So how did that process start?
When Charles Smith was caught, and I actually got the call, I think it was 16 years after I was, you know, convicted and charged, and I got a phone call, and he was caught, and I never thought he would get caught. I never thought anybody would ever believe me or believe my story. And when I got the news that they finally caught him and that I was not the only victim that he had done this to, I knew right then and there that there's something that I have to do to make sure that other people don't ever suffer the same way. It was very tragic, not only for myself, but for my children. It's a very grave disappointment that our justice system failed me, never having a criminal record, never being in jail. I had no idea. And it had failed me. It had failed my children. And in some ways, you know, it could have taken my life. There was a few times where I thought, I don't know if I'm going to make it through this. But during the course of the process of the prison system, you realize that you find some kind of inner strength to survive. And if you can do it in there, you could do it in the community. And depending on who you are and how you're coping and your strategies, some people find rehabilitation for their feelings and their emotions that have been broken by a system to work better when you're actually advocating for the cause. Because had Innocence Canada not come forward and helped me, I don't know where my life would be right now.
Do you think that your relationship with your children now has been affected by what happened?
There's no question the wrongful conviction has affected the lives of my children. They're grown adults now. My son is 30. My youngest is 23. And there's still a lot of very deep pain that comes out from time to time. And but we are strong as a unit. We're strong as a unit. There is nothing that could break us as a family, ever. I try and say to my children that giving up my freedom to not lose my children and for them to not lose a family unit, which we always deserve to be from day one, is something that I would do again if I had to.
That's amazing that your family can stay so strong after all of the trauma that it's been through.
Well, my son is also an advocate now, too. He actually does speaking engagements about what wrongful convictions do to children. You know, when I go out and I do speaking engagements, I start the presentation, and then my son comes in to finish it.
Earlier, when we were sending emails before the call, you said that, you know, you're trying to get out of the office on time. What kind of work do you do now? Is it related to your advocacy work?
Well, I'm very proud to say that I'm now a licensed paralegal here with the Law Society of Upper Canada. So I litigate in the lower levels of courts with summary conviction, criminal offenses, small claims, that kind of thing. But since the time that I was released, I worked with criminal lawyers for quite a while there. And then my husband went on to become a private investigator. And then he left that field and became a process server. So he serves legal documents in all jurisdictions. And my son is now a licensed paralegal with the Law Society as well. So trying to get my life together, and I waited 2010. So I waited 6 years to get my license because I passed my exams in 2010 with the Law Society paralegal exam, but then we couldn't move forward because of my wrongful conviction.
And what year was your exoneration finalized?
Well, we call it acquittal here in Canada. And actually, it was February 29th this year, 2016, which happened to fall on Leap Day.
Did you have like a big party? I mean, I'm imagining a celebration like no other.
I wouldn't say it was a big party. After we left the Court of Appeal, we went over to the Sheraton Center, and, you know, there's a restaurant there, and we all gathered there, and it just, my close friends that have been with me through this whole thing, we've been friends for almost 40 years. A number of them were all there, my family members, my legal team, Innocence Canada, WinWare, I had amazing support system. And yeah, we did have a little celebration there, but I haven't had like a full-blown huge party, if you want to call it.
What do you think that people who are not attorneys like myself can do to help people who have been wrongly convicted or wrongly accused of a crime?
I think the most important thing that I can say is that I don't ever want people to think that it can't happen to them and wait until it happens to them to take action or do something to help the cause. Because prevention is better than cure. If we do things collectively together to show that we're paying attention, that systemic flaws can be reduced by collective public outcry for proper justice, then I think that we're in a step in the right direction. So donating to a cause obviously is incredible. Innocence Projects, Innocence Canada, it's very helpful. I always say to people, it takes about $5 to get one page into a transcript for somebody wrongly convicted. That's 2 days of coffee, 3 days of coffee. And collectively, if people come together, then we can put that transcript together to bring it back before the justice system to have them look at it.
If you could give advice to someone who finds themselves in a position of wrongful conviction, what advice would you have for that person?
Never lose hope. As much as hope can seem very dim, hope does come in all different angles. We just have to know where to find it. Also, do not be afraid to look for help. Don't be afraid to ask for help. There's all kinds of support systems all over the world. And talk to your doctor. Talk to anybody that's willing to listen. Let them know your story. And if it means you have to say it a million times, then keep saying it, because you're innocent. You didn't do anything. Somebody's going to listen.
Is there anything that you think I should have asked or that you'd like to talk about that I didn't ask about?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Accountability. Accountability is huge. Accountability, see, Charles Smith used to be a former doctor at SickKids. SickKids is supposed to be one of the best hospitals in the world for children. To see and to know that Charles Smith and the two people above him did not have formal training in their field was a big blow to society. The fact that they were able to walk away with no criminal investigation, they resigned from their positions in exchange for no further investigation. In my view, that's wrong. There were many lives affected. A lot of kids, it broke up families. You know, these people went on to rise in their profession over a period of 20 years, whether it be promotions, salary increases. This is all based on their position that we now know they were never formally trained in. And so one has to wonder, they just got to walk away. I'm not looking for any kind of, I'm not wishing bad on any of them by any means. That's not the kind of person I am. I've forgiven Charles Smith for what has happened. I'll never forget what he's done to myself and my children and my family. But at the same time, there has to be more accountability. People have to be brought to justice. When you are called as an expert witness on that stand and you know fully well you're not formally trained in that field, then who are we kidding? We can't just let it walk away. We can't sweep it under the rug. It has to be addressed, whether it's in this case or any of the cases around the world. Accountability needs to be addressed. Perhaps the subject of what's it like getting out and what's life like for a lot of the people afterwards. You know, when you factor in that you walk away with a wrongful conviction, the stains aren't gone. People remember who you are. You're all over the internet. And some employers will not even consider bringing you on board just because of that.
I was just in Atlanta a couple of weekends ago, and I had a meeting with three men who had been exonerated and are not doing well. And it's so sad to hear their stories, because they talk about it would have been better if they had been actually guilty, because there's programs for people who are paroled here. But when you're exonerated, you're just done.
After post-acquittal for me, I remember seeing on social media some people still saying, you know, I should have been put in an electric chair. Somebody else said that I should have been raped and dumped in a ditch or something like that. It's just horrible because it doesn't matter what happens. You've been walking as a murderer for 25 years. And to try and just take that away, it's not a simple task by any means. And the resources available to a wrongly convicted person is minimal. It really is minimal. There's next to nothing. They just let you out, and then you're supposed to find your way. And there are programs that can help, but by no means does it give you a standard of living that you deserve, considering you've spent so many years away in prison for something that you've never done. To this day, I have no memory. I can't remember going into labor with my daughter. I don't have a picture of it in my head. I can't remember any of it. I think it was just too painful to know that, you know, while not actually in a prison setting per se, I was in a halfway house when I went into labor. And then from there, I don't remember I don't remember being in a hospital room. I don't remember any of that. And it's a terrible feeling to have. And I've been seeing a forensic psychologist for since 1991 off and on. So for the last 25 years, I've been seeing a forensic psychologist off and on.
My day job, I am actually a therapist for children. I've worked with kids who've had a parent incarcerated, and I know the damage that does. It must be very difficult, and I'm glad that your son talks about it, to have a parent that was incarcerated for something that they did not do. I just think that it's very noble that you tell your story and that you are an advocate for people and that you have found it in your heart to forgive, definitely not forget, but forgive the main person responsible for that. And I think that's an amazing character trait that you have.
It would have killed me, or would kill me, if I carried that kind of burden on my shoulders, to carry that much hatred. I couldn't do it. My mother never raised me that way. She's not here anymore. She died a few months before my acquittal. And that's a lingering pain in my heart. You know, that's just another thing that, you know, I carry with me on top of missing Cassandra so much. And then, you know, then my son, deep inside, he's broken. But when he gets up there to speak, he's a staunch advocate. You would be so amazed at how this young man talks. And he championed beside me all of these years. He never walked away. He always stood by his mother, even as young as 13. We're going to do this, Mom. Yeah, when I got the letter that Smith had been caught, he was the first one I ran to, and we cried in the car. What you're doing, Brooke, is a great thing. And you know, on behalf of wrongly convicted people, I'm ever so grateful that you're helping to raise awareness for the cause and for prevention as well.
There's a story that's, it was in Michigan, but the lady that I interviewed, her name was Julie Balmer, and she had adopted her nephew, and when he was 3 weeks old, he had a seizure. But the doctor, I have air quotes that you can't see, said that it was shaken baby syndrome. And it kills me that doctors can make statements like that and not know.
Well, what's really interesting in my case too, Brooke, is that at the time that I was going into entering the plea, I was told that Charles Smith wanted to add on shaken baby syndrome. And ultimately they stepped back from that. So I almost had to answer to that as well. So when I see people like Dr. Wayne Squires, who was stripped of her license, or she was either stripped of her license or, yeah, I think she was stripped of her license because they just recently reinstated her. Look up Dr. Wayne Squires. That's a pretty interesting story because she actually helped convict people before, saying that they had killed their children, and then she later went on to say that the medical evidence that she had done recently does not match, and she basically said that the new evidence cannot support the convictions that she had been involved in the past.
That's noble, too, to go and discredit yourself.
oh my gosh, what this woman has been, she's been targeted by the police now. And, you know, it takes a lot for a doctor to come forward and say that. Now, Charles Smith and the other two doctors, James Young, Jim Cairns, in my case, and in Tammy Markhart's case, any Smith cases, there was a public inquiry on that. And a provincial inquiry that was held that went on for about a month. And, you know, they got up on the stand and Charles Smith has said that his training was woefully inadequate, and but that he still stood by some of his findings. So I'm told he's a very cold, non-compassionate man. I still want to meet him, though.
What would you say to him?
What would I say to Charles Smith? I would like to sit with him in a room, just me and him, and just ask him why. You know, why would you choose me? Why did you do this to me? What have I done? What did I ever do to you to make you think that I would do something like this to my own child? And that I'm sure he knows publicly now that I have said openly that I forgive him, but I will never forget what's been done, and I'm still asking for accountability. And that I hope that the children that he has will never face the days that he's done to mine. And leave it at that.
I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening. You can access the schedule of the show for the remainder of the year by going to the Actual Innocence website, actualinpod.com, and then click on Upcoming Events under the About section. Basically, the show will be going every other week for the remainder of this calendar year, but the last three episodes, which are also the next three episodes, are going to be a three-part season finale that you will not want to miss. I'll share the stories of the meeting with the Georgia Innocence Project, stories from exonerees, and more about actual innocence itself. Now, here's Stephanie with the credits.
This episode of Actual Innocence was hosted and produced by Brooke Giddings. The Actual Innocence volunteer team is Stephanie Satilli, Sarah Nelson, Megan Delaney, and Casey Sanders, with production assistance from Matt Ryan. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. Visit our website, actualinpod.com, for volunteer opportunities, ways to lend support, and to find out more information about the exonerees. Visit our website, www.actualinpod.com, for volunteer opportunities, ways to lend support, and to find out more information about the exonerees themselves. That's www.actualinpod.com. You can also find us on Twitter at actualinpod or email us at actualinnocencepod@gmail.com. We also have a Facebook group. Just request to join and someone will let you in. Special thanks to our sponsor, Framebridge, for supporting the show. Until next time, listen, learn, and advocate for justice. Thanks for listening.